And now I understand. You probably knew that all along. Live boldly, Clark. Good luck, shouted the Wheel of Fortune host and spun again. And I realized what I really wanted to do. I spent the next 3 days collating Margot's wardrobe, sorting the clothing into different sections, 6 different decades, and within those, daywear, evening wear, special occasion. I took out everything that needed repairing in any small way. Buttons missing, gaps in lace, tiny holes. Marvelling at how she had managed to avoid moths, and how many seams were not stretched, still perfectly aligned. I held pieces up against myself, tried things on, lifted off plastic covers, and letting out little noises of delight and awe that made Dean Martin prick up his ears, then walk away in disgust. I went to the public library and spent half a day looking up everything to do with starting a small business. Tax requirements, grants, paperwork, and printed out a file that grew day by day. Then I took a trip to the Village Clothes Emporium with Dean Martin and sat down with the girls to ask the best places to get delicate items dry cleaned and the names of the best haberdashers to find silk lining fabric for repair. They were agog at the news of Margot's gift.
"We could take the whole lot off you," said Lydia, blowing a smoke ring upwards. "I mean, for something like that, we could get a bank loan, right? We'd give you a good price, enough for a deposit on a really nice rental. We've had a lot of interest from this television company in Germany. They've got a 24-episode, multi-generational series that they want to..."
"Thanks, but I haven't decided what I want to do with it all yet," I said, trying not to notice their faces fall. I already felt a little protective about those clothes. I leant forward over the counter. "But I have had another idea." The following morning, I was trying on a 1970s lavender trouser suit, checking for rotten seams or tiny holes, when the doorbell rang.
"Hold on, Ashok! Hold on! Let me just grab the dog!" I called, scooping him up as he barked furiously at the door.
Michael stood in front of me. "Hello," I said coldly, when I had recovered from the shock. "Is there a problem?" He struggled not to raise an eyebrow at my outfit.
"Mr. Garpnick would like to see you."
"I'm here legitimately. Mrs. DeWitt invited me to stay on. It's not about that.
I don't know what it is, to tell you the truth, but he wants to talk to you about something."
"I don't really want to talk to him, Michael, but thanks anyway." I made to close the door, but he put his foot in it, stopping me. I looked down at it. Dean Martin let out a low growl.
"Louisa, you know what he's like. He said I wasn't to leave until you agreed."
"Tell him to walk down the corridor himself, then. It's hardly far." He lowered his voice.
"He doesn't want to see you here. He wants to see you in his office, in private."
He looked uncharacteristically uncomfortable, as someone might, who had professed they were your best friends, then dropped you like a hot stone.
"Tell him I might come by later this morning, then, when Dean Martin and I have had our walk."
Still, he didn't move.
"What?"
He looked at me, almost pleading. "The car is waiting outside." I brought Dean Martin. He was a useful distraction from my vague sense of anxiety. Michael sat beside me in the limousine, and Dean Martin glared at him and at the back of the driver's seat simultaneously. I sat in silence, wondering what on earth Mr. Gopnik was going to do now. If he had decided to press charges, surely he would have sent the police rather than his car. Had he waited deliberately until Margot had gone? Had he uncovered other things I was about to be blamed for? I thought of Stephen Lipcott's and the pregnancy test, and wondered what my response would be if he asked point-blank what I knew. Will had always said I had the worst poker face. I practiced in my head, "I know nothing," until Michael shot me a sharp look and I realized I'd started saying it out loud. We were discharged in front of a huge glass building. Michael walked briskly through the cavernous marble-clad lobby, but I refused to hurry, and instead let Dean Martin amble along at his own pace, even though I could tell it infuriated Michael. He collected a pass from security, handed it to me, then directed me towards a separate lift near the back of the lobby. Mr. Gopnik was plainly too important to travel up and down with the rest of his staff. We went up to the 46th floor, travelling at a speed that made my eyes bulge almost as much as Dean Martin's,
and I tried to hide the slight wobble in my legs as I stepped out into the hushed silence of the offices. A secretary, immaculately dressed in a tailored suit and spiked heels, did a double take at me. I guess they didn't get too many people dressed in 1970s lavender Givenchy trouser suits with leopard skin collars, clutching furious small dogs. I followed Michael along a corridor to another office, in which sat another woman, also immaculately dressed in her office uniform. "I have Miss Clark to see Mr. Gartnick, Diane," he said. She nodded and lifted a phone, murmuring something into it. "He'll see you now," she said with a small smile. Michael pointed me towards the door. "Do you want me to take the dog?" he said. He was plainly desperate for me not to take the dog. "No, thank you," I said, holding Dean Martin a little tighter to me. The door opened, and there stood Leonard Gopnik in his shirt sleeves. "Thank you for agreeing to see me," he said, closing the door behind him. He gestured towards a seat on the other side of the desk and walked slowly around it. I noticed his limp was pronounced and wondered what Nathan was doing with him. He always was too discreet to discuss it. I said nothing. He sat down heavily in his chair. He looked tired, I noticed. The expensive tan unable to hide the shadows under his eyes, the strain lines at their edges. "You're taking your duties very seriously," he said, gesturing at the dog. "I always do," I said, and he nodded, as if that were a fair comeback. Then he leant forward over the desk and steepled his fingers. "I'm not someone, Louisa, used to finding myself lost for words. But I confess I am right now. I discovered something 2 days ago, something which has left me rather shaken." He looked up at me. I looked steadily back at him, my expression a study in neutrality. My daughter Tabitha had become suspicious about some things she'd heard, and put a private investigator on the case. This is not something I'm particularly happy about. We are not, as a family, prone to investigating each other. But when she told me what the gentleman had found, it was not something I could ignore. I talked to Agnes about it, and she has told me everything. I waited. "The child." "Oh," I said. He sighed. "During these rather extensive discussions, she also explained about the piano, the money for which, I understand, you were under instruction to remove in increments, day by day, from a nearby ATM. "Yes, Mr. Gopnik," I said. He lowered his head as if he had hoped against hope that I might dispute the facts, tell him that it was all nonsense, that the private investigator was talking rubbish. Finally, he sat back heavily in his chair. "We appear to have done you a great wrong, Louisa." "I'm not a thief, Mr. Gopnik." "Plainly. And yet, out of loyalty to my wife, you were prepared to let me believe you were." I wasn't sure if it was a criticism. I didn't feel like I had a choice. "Oh, you did. You absolutely did." We sat in the cool office in silence for a few moments. He tapped on his desk with his fingers. "Louisa, I have spent much of the night trying to work out how I can put this situation right. And I'd like to make you an offer." I waited. "I'd like to give you your job back. You will, of course, receive better terms, longer holidays, a pay rise, significantly improved benefits. If you would rather not live on site, we can arrange accommodation nearby." "A job?" "Agnes hasn't found anyone she likes half as much as she liked you. You have more than proven yourself, and I'm immensely grateful for your loyalty and your continued discretion. The girl we took on after you has been, well, she's not up to it. Agnes doesn't like her. She considered you more of a friend." I looked down at the dog. He looked up at me. He seemed distinctly unimpressed. "Mr. Gopnik, that's very flattering, but I don't think I would feel comfortable working as Agnes's assistant now. There are other positions within my organization. I understand that you do not have another job yet." "Who told you that?" "There's not a lot that goes on in my building that I don't know about, Louisa. Usually, at least." He allowed himself a wry smile.
Look, we have openings in our marketing and administrative departments. I could ask human resources to bypass certain entry requirements, and we could offer you training. Or I would be prepared to create a position in my philanthropic arm if you felt that was something you were interested in. What do you say? He sat back, one arm on his desk, his ebonized pen loose in his hand. An image of this alternative life swam before my eyes. Me, dressed in a suit, headed to work each day in these vast glass offices. Louisa Clark, earning a big salary, living somewhere I could afford. A New Yorker, not looking after anyone for once, just pushing upwards, the sky limitless above me. It would be a whole new life, a real shot at the American dream. I thought of my family's pride if I said yes. I thought of a scruffy warehouse downtown, filled to the brim with other people's old clothes. Mr. Gopnik, again, I'm very flattered, but I don't think so. His expression hardened. So you do want money? I blinked. I'm aware we live in a litigious society, Louisa. I am conscious that you hold highly sensitive information about my family. If it's a lump sum you're after, we'll talk about it. I can bring my lawyer into the discussion. He leant over and put his finger on the intercom. Diane, can you... It was at this point that I stood. I lowered Dean Martin gently to the floor. Mr. Gopnik, I don't want your money. If I'd wanted to sue you or make money from your secrets, I would have done it weeks ago, when I was left without a job or anywhere to live. You've misjudged me now, as you misjudged me back then. And I'd like to leave now, please. He took his finger off the phone. Please, sit. I didn't mean to offend you. He motioned to the chair. Please, Louisa. I need to get this matter sorted out. He didn't trust me. I saw now that Mr. Gopnik lived in a world where money and status were prized so far above everything else that it was inconceivable to him that somebody wouldn't try to extract some, given the opportunity. You want me to sign something? I said coolly. I want to know your price. And then it occurred to me. Perhaps I did have one, after all. I sat down again, and after a moment I told him, and for the first time in the 9 months that we'd met, he looked properly surprised. That's what you want. That's what I want. I don't care how you do it. He leant back in his chair and placed his hands behind his head. He looked off to the side, thinking for a moment, then turned back to me. I rather wish you would come back and work for me, Louisa Clark, he said. And then he smiled for the first time and reached across the desk to shake my hand. Letter for you, said Ashok as I walked in. Mr. Gopnik had instructed that the car should bring me home, and I had asked the driver to drop me 2 blocks away so that Dean Martin could stretch his legs. I was still shaking from the encounter. I felt light-headed, elated, as if I were capable of anything. Ashok had to call twice before I registered what he'd said. For me? I stared down at the address. I couldn't think who knew I was living at Mrs. DeWitt's, aside from my parents, and they were as likely to write me a letter as they were to move to New York. I ran upstairs, gave Dean Martin a drink, then sat down to open it. The handwriting was unfamiliar, so I flicked the letter over. It was written on cheap copier paper, in black ink, and there were a couple of crossings out, as if the writer had struggled with what he wanted to say. Sam. Chapter 30. Dear Lou, I wasn't entirely truthful when we last met, so I'm writing to you now. Not because I think it will change anything, but because I deceived you once, and it's important to me that you know I will never mislead or deceive you again. I'm not with Katie. I wasn't when I last saw you. I don't want to say too much, but it became clear pretty quickly that we are very different people, and that I had made a huge mistake. If I'm honest, I think I knew it from the start. She is put in for a transfer, and although they don't like it much at head office, it looks like they'll go ahead with it. I'm left feeling like a fool, and rightly so. Not a day goes by when I don't wish I'd just written you a few lines every day, like you asked, or sent the odd postcard.
I should have hung on tighter. I should have told you what I felt when I felt it. I should have just tried a bit harder, instead of throwing myself a pity party at the thought of all the people who had left me behind. Like I said, I'm not writing to change your mind. I know you've moved on. I just wanted to tell you I'm sorry, and that I'll always regret what happened, and that I really hope you're happy. It's kind of hard to tell at a funeral. Take care of yourself, Louisa. Love always, Sam. I felt giddy. Then I felt a bit sick. And then I gulped, swallowed a huge sob of an emotion I couldn't quite identify. And then I screwed the letter up in a ball and with a roar hurled it with force into the bin. I sent Margot a picture of Dean Martin and wrote her a short letter updating her on his well-being, just to calm my nerves. I walked up and down the empty apartment and swore a bit. I poured myself a sherry from Margot's dusty drinks cabinet and drank it in three gulps, although it wasn't even lunchtime. And then I pulled the letter out of the bin, opened my laptop, sat on the hall floor with my back to Margot's front door so that I could use the Gopnik's Wi-Fi, and emailed Sam. What kind of bullshit letter is that? Why would you send me that now, after all this time? The answer came back within minutes, as if he had been sitting waiting at his computer. I get your anger. I'd probably be angry too. But Lily said you were thinking of getting married, and the whole looking at apartments and Little Italy thing just made me think if I didn't tell you now, it was going to be too late. I stared at my screen, frowning. I reread what he'd written, twice. Then I typed, Lily told you that? Yes. And the thing about you thinking it was a bit soon and not wanting him to think you were doing it for the residency, but how his proposal made it impossible for you to say no. I waited a few minutes, then I typed, carefully, Sam, what did she tell you about the proposal? That Josh had gone down on one knee at the top of the Empire State Building? And about the opera singer he hired? Lou, don't be angry with her. I know I shouldn't have made her tell me. I know it's none of my business. But I just asked her how you were the other day. I wanted to know what was going on in your life. And then she kind of knocked me sideways with all this stuff. I told myself just to be glad you were happy, but I kept thinking, what if I had been that guy? What if I had, I don't know, seized the moment? I closed my eyes. So you wrote to me because Lily told you I was about to get married? No, I wanted to write to you anyway. I've done since I saw you in Stortfold. I just didn't know what to say. But then I figured once you were married, especially if you were getting married so quickly, it was going to be impossible for me to say anything afterwards. Maybe that's old-fashioned of me. Look, I basically just wanted you to know I was sorry, Lou. That's it. I'm sorry if this is inappropriate. It took a while before I wrote again. Okay, well, thanks for letting me know. I shut the lid and leant back against the front door and closed my eyes for a long time. I decided not to think about it. I was quite good at not thinking about things. I did my household errands, and I took Dean Martin on his walks, and I travelled to the East Village on the subway, in the stifling heat, and discussed square footage and partitions, and leases and insurances with the girls. I did not think about Sam. I did not think about him when I walked the dog past the vomiter's ever-present garbage trucks, or dodged the honking UPS vans, or twisted my ankles on the cobbles of Soho, or lugged holdalls of clothing through the turnstiles of the subway. I recited Margot's words, and I did the thing I loved, which had now grown from a tiny germ of an idea into a huge oxygenated bubble, which inflated from the inside of me, steadily pushing out everything else. I did not think about Sam. His next letter arrived 3 days later. I recognised the handwriting this time, scrawled across an envelope that Ashok had pushed under my door. So I thought about our email exchange, and I just wanted to talk to you about a couple more things. You didn't say I couldn't, so I hope you're not going to rip this up. Lou, I never knew you even wanted to get married. I feel stupid for not asking you about that now. And I didn't realise you were the kind of girl who secretly wanted big romantic gestures. But Lily has told me so much about what Josh does for you. The weekly roses, the fancy dinners and stuff. And I'm sitting here thinking, was I really so static? How did I just sit there and expect that everything was going to be okay if I didn't even try? Lou, did I get this wrong? I just need to know if the whole time we were together you were waiting for me to make some grand gesture. If I misread you. If I did, I'm sorry again. It's kind of odd to have to think about yourself so much, especially if you're a bloke not massively prone to introspection. I like doing stuff, not thinking about it. But I guess I need to learn a lesson here, and I'm asking you if you'd be kind enough to tell me. I took one of Margot's faded notelets with the address at the top. I crossed out her name, and I wrote, Sam, I never wanted anything grand from you. Nothing. Louisa. I ran down the stairs, handed it to Ashok for posting, and ran away just as quickly, pretending I couldn't hear him asking if everything was okay. The next letter arrived within days. Each was express delivery. It had to be costing him an absolute fortune. You did, though. You wanted me to write, and I didn't do it. I was always too tired, or, if I'm being honest, I felt self-conscious. I didn't feel like I was talking to you, just chuntering away on paper. It felt fake. And then the more I didn't do it, and the more you started adapting your life there and changing, I felt like, well, what the hell do I have to tell her anyway? She's going to these fancy balls and country clubs and riding around in limousines and having the time of her life. And I'm riding around in an ambulance in East London, picking up drunks and lonely pensioners who have fallen out of bed. Okay, I'm going to tell you something else now, Lou. And if you never want to hear from me again, I will understand. But now we're talking again, I have to say it. I'm not glad for you. I don't think you should marry him. I know he's smart and handsome and rich and hires string quartets for you when you're eating dinner on his roof terrace and stuff, but there's something there I don't trust. I don't think he's right for you. Oh, crap. It's not even just about you. It's driving me nuts. I hate thinking of you with him. Even the thought of him with his arm around you makes me want to punch things. I don't sleep properly anymore, because I've turned into this stupid jealous guy who has to train his mind to think about other stuff. And you know me, I sleep anywhere. You're probably reading this now and thinking, good, you dickhead, serves you right, and you'd be entitled. Just don't rush into anything, okay? Make sure he really is all the things you deserve. Or, you know, don't marry him at all. Sam, kiss. I didn't respond for a few days that time. I carried the letter around with me. And I looked at it in the quiet moments at the vintage clothes emporium, and when I stopped for coffee in the dog-friendly diner near Columbus Circle. I reread it when I was getting into my sagging bed at night, and thought about it when I was soaking in Margot's little salmon-coloured bathtub. And then finally, I wrote back. Dear Sam, I'm not with Josh anymore. To use your phrase, we turned out to be very different people. Lou. P.S. For what it's worth, the thought of a violinist hovering over me while I'm trying to eat makes my toes curl. Chapter 31. Dear Louisa, I had my first decent night's sleep in weeks. I found your letter when I got back from a night shift at 6 a.m, and I have to tell you, it made me so bloody glad that I wanted to shout like a crazy person and do a dance. But I'm crap at dancing, and I had nobody to talk to, so I went and let the hens out and sat on the step and told them instead. They were not massively impressed, but what do they know? So, can I write? I have stuff to say now. I also have a really stupid grin on my face for about 80% of my working day. My new partner, Dave, 45, definitely not about to bring me French novels, says I'm scaring the patients. Tell me what's going on with you. Are you okay? Are you sad? You didn't sound sad. Maybe I just want you not to be sad. Talk to me. Love, Sam. Kiss. The letters arrived most days. Some were long and rambling, some just a couple of lines, a few scribbles or a photo of him showing different parts of his now-completed house. Or hens. Sometimes the letters were long, exploratory, fervent. We went too fast, Louisa Clark. Perhaps my injury accelerated it all. You can't play hard to get with someone after they've literally held your insides with their bare hands, after all. So maybe this is good. Maybe now we get to really talk to each other. I was a mess after Christmas. I can tell you that now. I like to feel I've done the right thing. But I didn't do the right thing. I hurt you and it haunted me. There were so many nights when I just gave up on sleep and went to work on the house instead. I'd fully recommend behaving like an arse if you want to get a building project completed. I think about my sister a lot, mostly what she'd say to me. You don't have to have known her to imagine what she'd be calling me right now. Day after day they came, sometimes two in 24 hours, sometimes supplemented by an email, but most often just long, handwritten essays. Windows into the inside of Sam's head and heart. Some days I almost didn't want to read them, afraid to renew an intimacy with the man who had so comprehensively broken my heart. On others, I found myself running downstairs barefoot in the mornings, Dean Martin at my heels, standing in front of a Shook and bouncing on my toes as he flicked through the wedge of post on his desk. He would pretend there was nothing, then pull one from his jacket and hand it over with a smile as I bolted back upstairs to enjoy it in private. I read them over and over, discovering with each new one how little we had really known each other before I left, building a new picture of this quiet, complicated man. Sometimes his letters made me sad. Really sorry, no time today. Lost two kids in an RTA. Just need to go to bed. Kiss. P.S. I hope your day was full of good things. But mostly they did not. He talked of Jake and how Jake had told him that Lily was the only person who really understood how he felt, and how each week Sam would take Jake's dad on a walk along the canal path, or make him help paint the walls of the new house, just to try to get him to open up a bit and to stop eating cake. He talked of the two hens he had lost to a fox, the carrots and beetroot that were growing in his vegetable patch. He told me how he had kicked his bike exhaust in desperation and fury on Christmas Day, after he had left me at my parents', and hadn't had the dent repaired because it was a useful reminder of how miserable he had felt when we weren't talking. Every day he opened up a little more, and every day I felt I understood him a little better. "Did I tell you Lily stopped by today? I finally told her that you and I had been in touch, and she went bright pink and coughed out a piece of gum. Seriously, I thought I was going to have to do the Heimlich on her." I wrote back in the hours when I was neither working nor walking Dean Martin. I drew him little vignettes of my life, my careful cataloguing and repairing of Margot's wardrobe, sending photographs of items that fitted me as if they had been made for me. He told me he pinned these up in his kitchen. I told him of how Margot's idea of the dress agency had taken root in my imagination, and how I couldn't let it go. I told him of my other correspondence, spidery little cards from Margot, still radiant with joy at her son's forgiveness, and from her daughter-in-law, Lainey, who sent me sweet flowered cards updating me on Margot's deteriorating condition, and thanking me for bringing her husband some closure, expressing her sadness that it had taken so long for it to happen. I told Sam how I had begun to look for apartments, how I had headed, with Dean Martin, into unfamiliar new neighbourhoods. Jackson Heights, Queens, Park Slope, one eye trying to assess the risk of being murdered in my bed, the other trying not to balk at the terrifying differential between square footage and cost. I told him of my now weekly dinners with the Shooks family, how their casual insults and evident love for each other made me miss my own. I told him how my thoughts returned again and again to Grandad, far more so than when he was alive, and how Mum, freed from all responsibility, was still finding it impossible to stop grieving him. I told him how, despite spending more time by myself than I had in years, despite living in the vast, empty apartment, I felt, curiously, not lonely at all. And gradually, I let him know what it meant to me to have him in my life again, his voice in my ear in the small hours, the knowledge that I meant something to him. The sense of him as a physical presence, despite the miles that separated us. Finally, I told him I missed him, and realized almost as I pressed send that that really didn't solve anything at all. Nathan and Ilaria came for dinner, Nathan bringing a clutch of beers, and Ilaria a spicy pork and bean casserole that nobody had wanted. I had thought about how often Ilaria seemed to cook dishes that nobody wanted. The previous week she had brought over a prawn curry, which I distinctly remembered Agnes telling her never to serve again. We sat with our bowls on our lap, side by side on Margot's sofa, mopping up the rich tomato sauce with chunks of cornbread, and trying not to belch at each other as we talked over the television. Ilaria asked after Margot, crossing herself and shaking her head sadly when I told her of Lainey's updates. In turn, she told me Agnes had banned Tabitha from the apartment, a cause of some stress for Mr. Gopnik, who had chosen to deal with this particular family fracture by spending even more time at work.
"To be fair, there's a lot going on at the office," said Nathan.
"There's a lot going on across the corridor,"
Ilaria raised an eyebrow at me.
"The Puta has a daughter,"
she said quietly when Nathan got up to visit the bathroom, wiping her hands on a napkin.
"I know," I said.
"She is coming to visit with the Puta's sister."
She sniffed, picked a loose thread on her trousers.
"Poor child. It is not her fault she is coming to visit with a family of crazies."
"You'll look out for her," I said. "You're good at that."
"Colour of that bathroom," said Nathan, arriving back in the room. "I didn't think anyone did cloakroom suites in mint green.
You know there's a bottle of body lotion in there dated 1974.
Ilaria raised her eyebrows and compressed her lips. Nathan left at 9:15, and as the door closed behind him, Ilaria lowered her voice, as if he could still hear, and told me he was dating a personal trainer from Bushwick who wanted him to visit at all hours of the day and night. Between the girl and Mr. Gopnik, he barely had time to talk to anybody these days.
"What could you do?"
"Nothing," I said. "People were going to do what they were going to do." She nodded, as if I had imparted some great wisdom, and padded back down the corridor.
"Can I ask you something?"
"Sure.
Nadia, baby, take that through to Grandma, will you?"
Mina stooped to give the child a small plastic cup of iced water. It was a sweltering evening, and every window in Ashok and Mina's apartment was open. Despite the two fans that whirred lazily, the air was still stubbornly resistant to movement. We were preparing supper in the tiny kitchen, and every motion seemed to make a bit of me stick to something.
"Has Ashok ever hurt you?"
Mina turned swiftly from the stove to face me. "Not physically, I mean, just..."
"My feelings? As in messing me around? Not too much, to be honest. He's not really built that way. He did once joke that I looked like a whale when I was 42 weeks pregnant with Roshana. But after I got past the hormones and stuff, I kind of had to agree with him. And boy, did he pay for that one."
She let out a honking laugh at the memory, then reached into a cupboard for some rice.
"Is this your guy in London again?"
"He writes to me. Every day. But I..."
"You what?"
I shrugged. "I'm afraid. I loved him so much, and it was so awful when we split up. I guess I'm just afraid that if I let myself fall again, I'll be setting myself up for more hurt. It's complicated."
"It's always complicated."
She wiped her hands on her apron.
"That's life, Louisa. So show me."
"What?"
"The letters. Come on, don't pretend you don't carry them around all day. Ashok says your whole face goes kind of mushy when he hands one over."
"I thought doormen were meant to be discreet."
"That man has no secrets from me. You know that. We are highly invested in the twists and turns of your life down there."
She laughed and held out her hand, waggling her fingers impatiently. I hesitated just a moment, then pulled the letters carefully from my handbag. And, oblivious to the comings and goings of her small children, to the muffled laughter of her mother at the television comedy next door, to the noise and the sweat and the rhythmic click, click, click of the overhead fan, Mina bent her head over my letters and read them. "The strangest thing, Lou. So I've spent 3 years building this downhouse, obsessing over the right window frames and which kind of shower cubicle, and whether to go with the white plastic power sockets or the polished nickel. And now it's done, or as done as it will ever be. And I sit here alone in my immaculate front room, with the perfect shade of pale grey paint, and the reconditioned wood burner, and the triple pleat interlined curtains that my mum helped me choose. And I wonder, well, what was the bloody point? What did I build it for? I think I needed a distraction from the loss of my sister. I built a house so I didn't have to think. I built a house because I needed to believe in the future. But now it's done, and I look around these empty rooms, I feel nothing.
Maybe some pride that I actually finished the job, but apart from that, nothing at all.
Mina stared at the last few lines for a long moment. Then she folded the letter, placed it carefully in the pile, and handed them back to me.
"Oh, Louisa,"
she said, her head cocked to one side.
"Come on, girl!"
1442 Lantern Drive, Tuckahoe, Westchester, NY. Dear Louisa, I hope you are well and that the apartment is not proving too troublesome. Frank says the contractors are coming to look around in 2 weeks. Could you be there to let them in? We'll give you the firm details nearer the time. Margot isn't up to writing too much these days. She finds a lot of things tiring, and those drugs do make her a little woozy. But I thought you'd like to know that she is being well cared for. We have decided, despite everything, we cannot bear to move her into the home, so she will stay with us, with some help from the very kind medical staff. She still has plenty to say to Frank and me. Oh, yes. She has us running round like headless chickens most days. I don't mind. I quite like having someone to look after. And on her good days, it's lovely hearing all the stories of when Frank was a boy. I think he likes hearing them, too, even though he won't admit as much. Two peas in a pod, those two. Margot asked me to ask you, would you mind sending another picture of the dog? She did so like the other one you sent. Frank has put it in a lovely silver frame beside her bed, and I know it's a great comfort to her, as she spends so much time resting now. I can't say I find the little fellow quite as pleasing to look at as she plainly does, but each to her own. She sends you her love and says she hopes you're still wearing those gorgeous stripy pantyhose. I'm not sure if that's the pharmaceuticals talking, but I know she means well. With warmest wishes, Lainey G. Weber.
Did you hear?
I was headed out with Dean Martin to work. Summer had begun to assert its presence forcefully, every day warmer and more humid, so that the short walk to the subway left my shirt stuck to my lower back, and delivery boys exposed pale, sunburnt flesh on their bikes and swore at jaywalking tourists. But I was wearing my 1960s psychedelic dress that Sam had bought me, and a pair of cork-wedge shoes with pink flowers over the strap, and after the winter I'd had, the sun on my arms was like a balm.
Did I hear what? The library! It's been saved! Its future has been secured for the next 10 years!
He thrust his phone at me. I stopped on the carpet and lifted my sunglasses to read the text message from Mina.
I can't believe it! An anonymous donation in honor of some dead guy that...
Hang on, I got it here. He scanned the message with a finger.
The William Traynor Memorial Library. But who cares who it is? Funding for 10 years, Louisa! And the city council has agreed! 10 years! Oh, man! Mina is over the moon! She was so sure we'd lost it.
I peered at the phone, then handed it back to him. It's a nice thing, right?
It's amazing! Who knew, Louisa, huh? Who knew? One for the little people. Oh, yes!
Ashok's smile was enormous. I felt something rise inside me then, a feeling of joy, an anticipation so great, it seemed as if the world had briefly stopped turning. Like there was just me and the universe and a million good things that could happen if you only hung on in there. I looked down at Dean Martin, then back at the lobby. I waved to Ashok, adjusted my sunglasses and set off down Fifth Avenue, my own smile growing wider with every step. I had only asked for 5.
Chapter 32. So I guess at some point we have to talk about the fact that your year is nearly up. Do you have a date in mind to come home? I'm guessing you can't stay in the old woman's place forever. I've been thinking about your dress agency. Lou, you could use my house as a base if you wanted. Got a lot of spare room here, completely free. If you fancied it, you could stay too. If you think it's too soon for that, but you don't want to disrupt your sister's life by moving back to the flat, you could have the railway carriage. This is not my preferred option, by the way, but you always loved it, and there is something quite appealing in the thought of having you just across the garden. There is, of course, another option, which is that this is all too much and you don't want anything to do with me. But I don't like that one. It's a crappy option. I hope you think so too. Thoughts? Sam. Kiss. P.S. picked up a couple who had been married 56 years tonight. He had breathing difficulties, nothing too serious, and she wouldn't let go of his hand. Fussed over him until they got to hospital. I don't usually notice these things, but tonight, I don't know. I miss you, Louisa Clark. I walked the length of Fifth Avenue, with its clogged artery of traffic and its brightly coloured tourists blocking sidewalks, and I thought how lucky you might be to find not one, but two extraordinary men to love. And what a fluke it was if they happened to love you back. I thought about how you're shaped so much by the people who surround you, and how careful you have to be in choosing them for this exact reason. And then I thought, despite all that, in the end, maybe you have to lose them all in order to truly find yourself. I thought about Sam, and a couple who had been married for 56 years, whom I would never meet, and his name in my head became the drumbeat of my footfall as I walked past the Rockefeller Plaza, past the glitz of Trump Tower, past St. Patrick's, past the huge glowing Uniqlo, with its dazzling pixelated screens, past Bryant Park, the vast and ornate New York Public Library, with its vigilant masonry lions, the shops, the hoardings, the tourists, the street vendors and rough sleepers, all the daily features of a life I loved in a city that he didn't inhabit. And yet, above the noise and the sirens and the blare of the horns, I realized he was there at every step. Sam, Sam, Sam. And then I thought about how it would feel to go home.
28th October, 2006. Mum, in haste, I'm coming back to England. I got the job with Roop's firm, so I'll be handing in my notice tomorrow, and no doubt headed out of the office with my belongings in a box minutes later. These Wall Street firms don't like to hang on to people out here if they think you might plunder the client lists. So, come the new year, I'll be executive director in mergers and acquisitions back in London. Really looking forward to a new challenge. Thought I'd take a little break first. Might do that month-long Patagonian trek I've been going on about. And then I'll have to find somewhere to live. If you get the chance, could you sign me up with some estate agents? Usual postcodes, very central, 2-3 beds. Underground parking for the bike, if possible. Yes, I know you hate me using it. Oh, and you'll like this. I met someone. Alicia de Ware. She's actually English, but she's out here visiting friends. And I met her at a bloody awful dinner, and we went out a few times before she had to head back to Notting Hill. Proper dating, not the New York kind. Early days, but she's good fun. I'll be seeing a bit of her when I come back. Don't go looking at wedding hats just yet, though. You know me. So that's it. Give my love to Dad. Tell him I'll be buying him a pint or two at the Royal Oak very soon. To new beginnings, eh? With love, your son, Will. Kiss. I read and reread Will's letter, with its hints of a parallel universe, and what might have been landed gently around me like falling snow. I read between the lines at the future that could have been his and Alicia's, or even his and mine. More than once, William John Traynor had pushed the course of my life off its predetermined rails, not with a nudge, but with an emphatic shove. By sending me his correspondence, Camilla Traynor had inadvertently ensured he did it again. To new beginnings, eh? I read his words once more, then folded the letter carefully with the others, and sat thinking. Then I poured myself the last of Margot's vermouth, stared into space for a bit, sighed, walked to the front door with my laptop, sat on the floor and wrote. Dear Sam, I'm not ready. I know it's been almost a year and I originally said that was it, but here's the thing. I'm not ready to come home. All my life I've ended up looking after other people, fitting myself around what they need, what they wanted. I'm good at it. I do it before I even realise what I'm doing. I'm probably doing it to you too. You have no idea how much right now I want to book a flight and just be with you. But this last couple of months something has happened to me. Something that stops me doing just that. I'm opening my dress agency here. It's going to be called the Bee's Knees, and it's going to be based at the corner of the Vintage Clothes Emporium. And clients can buy from the girls or rent from me. We're pooling contacts, stumping up for some advertising, and I hope we'll help each other get business. I open my doors on Friday, and I've been writing to everyone I can think of. Already we've had a whole lot of interest from film production people and fashion magazines,
and even women who just want to hire something for fancy dress. You would not believe the number of man-men-themed parties in Manhattan. It's going to be hard, and I'm going to be broke, and when I'm home each night I pretty much fall asleep on my feet. But for the first time in my life, Sam, I wake up excited. I love meeting the customers and working out what is going to look good on them. I love stitching these beautiful old clothes to make them as good as new. I love the fact that every day I get to reimagine who I want to be. You once told me you'd wanted to be a paramedic from when you were a boy. Well, I've waited nearly 30 years to work out who I'm meant to be. This dream of mine might last a week or it might last a year. But every day I head down to the East Village with my holdalls full of clothes and my arms ache and I feel like I'll never be ready. And, well, I just feel like singing. I think about your sister a lot. I think about Will, too. When people we love die young, it's a nudge, reminding us that we shouldn't take any of it for granted, that we have a duty to make the most of what we have. I feel like I finally get that. So here it is. I've never really asked anyone for anything. But if you love me, Sam, I want you to join me, at least while I see if I can make this thing happen. I've done some research and there's an exam you need to pass, and apparently hiring in New York State is seasonal, but they do need paramedics. You could rent out your house for an income, and we could get a little apartment in Queens, or maybe the cheaper reaches of Brooklyn. And every day, we would wake up together, and, well, nothing would make me happier. And I would do everything I could, in the hours that I'm not covered with dust and moths and stray sequins, to make you glad you were here with me. I guess I want it all. You only get one life, right? You once asked me if I wanted a grand gesture. Well, here it is. I'll be where your sister always wanted to be, the evening of 25th July at 7 p.m. You know where to find me if the answer's yes. If not, I'll stand there for a while, take a long view, and just be glad that even if it was only in this way, we found each other again. All my love, always, Louisa. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Chapter 33. I saw Agnes once more before I finally left the lavery. I had staggered in with two armfuls of clothing that I was bringing home for repair, the plastic covers sticking uncomfortably to my skin in the heat. As I walked past the front desk, two dresses slid to the floor. Ashok leapt forward to pick them up for me, and I struggled to keep hold of the rest.
You got your work cut out this evening.
I certainly have. Getting this lot back on the subway was an absolute nightmare.
I can believe it. Oh, excuse me, Mrs. Gartnick. I'll just get those out of your way.
I looked up as Ashok swept my dresses from the carpet with a fluid movement and took a step back to allow Agnes through unimpeded. I straightened as she passed, as far as I could with my arms full of clothes. She was wearing a simple shift dress with a wide scoop neck and flat pumps, and looked, as she always did, as if somehow the prevailing weather conditions, whether extreme heat or cold, simply didn't apply to her. She was holding the hand of a small girl, around 4 or 5 years old, in a pinafore dress, who slowed to peer up at the brightly coloured garments I was holding in front of me. She had honey blonde hair, which tapered to fine curls, combed back neatly into two velvet bows, and her mother's slanting eye. And as she looked at me, she allowed herself a small, mischievous smile at my predicament. I couldn't help but grin back, and as I did, Agnes turned to see what the child was looking at, and our eyes locked. I froze briefly, made to straighten my face, but before I could, the corners of her mouth twitched, like her daughter's, almost as if she couldn't help herself. She nodded at me, a gesture so small that it's possible only I could have seen it. And then she stepped through the door that Ashok was holding back, the child already breaking into a skip, and they were gone, swallowed by the sunlight and the ever-moving human traffic of Fifth Avenue. Chapter 34. 25th July. Dear Lou,
well, I had to read that twice just to check I'd got it right. I looked at the girl in those newspaper pictures and I thought, can this possibly be my little girl in an actual New York newspaper? Those are wonderful pictures of you with all your dresses, and you look so gorgeous dressed up with your friends.
Did I tell you how proud Daddy and I are? We've cut out the ones from the free sheet, and Daddy has screenshotted all the ones we could find on the internet. Did I tell you he started a computer course at the Adult Education Centre? He'll be Stortford's Bill Gates next. We're sending you all our love, and I know you'll make a success of it, Lou. You sounded so upbeat and bold on the telephone. When you rang off, I sat there staring at the phone, and I couldn't believe this was my little girl, full of plans, calling from her own business across the Atlantic. It is the Atlantic, isn't it? I always get it mixed up with the Pacific. So here's our big news. We're going to come and see you later in the summer. We'll come when it cools down a bit. Didn't much like the sound of that heat wave of yours. You know, your daddy chafes in unfortunate places. Deirdre from the travel agents is letting us use her staff discount, and we're booking the flights at the end of this week. Could we stay with you in the old lady's flat? If not, could you tell us where to go? Nowhere with bed bugs. Let me know what dates suit you. I'm so excited. Ever so much love. Mum. Kiss, kiss, kiss. P.S. Did I tell you Trina's got a promotion? She always was such a smart girl. You know, I can see why Eddie is so keen on her. Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. I stood in the epicentre of Manhattan, in front of the towering building, letting my breathing slow, and stared at the gilded sign above the vast entrance to 30 Rockefeller Plaza. Around me, New York teemed in the evening heat, the sidewalks solid with meandering tourists, the air thick with blaring horns and the ever-present scent of exhaust and overheated rubber. Behind me, a woman with a 30 Rock golf shirt, her voice struggling to be heard over the racket, was giving a well-rehearsed tour speech to a group of Japanese sightseers. The building project was completed in 1933 by noted architect Raymond Hood in the Art Deco style. Sir, please stay together. Sir. Ma'am. Ma'am. And was originally named the RCA Building before becoming the GE Building in... Ma'am, over here, please. I gazed up at its 67 floors and took a deep breath. It was 6:45. I had wanted to look perfect for this moment, had planned to head back to the lavery at 5 to give myself time to shower and pick an appropriate outfit. I was thinking Deborah Kerr in An Affair to Remember. But fate had intervened in the form of a stylist from an Italian fashion magazine, who had arrived at the Vintage Clothing Emporium at 4:30. And wanted to look at all the two-piece suits for a feature she was planning. Then needed a colleague to try some on so she could take pictures and come back to me. Before I knew what was happening, it was 5:40, and I barely had time to run Dean Martin home and feed him before heading down here. So here I was, sweaty and a little frazzled, still in my work clothes, about to find out which way my life was about to go next. "Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this way to the observation deck, please." I had stopped running several minutes previously, but still felt breathless as I made my way across the plaza. I pushed the smoked glass door and noted with relief that the queue for tickets was short. I had checked on TripAdvisor the night before and been warned that queues could be lengthy, but felt somehow too superstitious to buy one in advance. So I waited my turn, checking my reflection in my compact, glancing around me surreptitiously on the off chance he had turned up early. Then bought a ticket that gave me access between the hours of 6:50 and 7:10, followed the velvet rope and waited while I was shepherded with a group of tourists towards a lift. 67 floors, they said, so high that the ride up was meant to make your ears pop. He would come. Of course he would come. What if he didn't? This was the thought that had crossed my mind ever since his one-line response to my email. "Okay, I hear you." Which really could have meant anything. I waited to see if he wanted to ask questions about my plan, or say anything else that hinted at his decision. I reread my own email, wondering if perhaps I had sounded off-putting, too bold, too assertive, whether I had conveyed my own strength of feeling. I loved Sam. I wanted him with me. Did he understand how much? That having issued the most enormous of ultimata, it seemed weird to start double-checking that it had been understood properly. So I simply waited. 6:55 p.m. the lift doors opened. I held out my ticket and stepped in. 67 floors. My stomach tightened. The lift began to move upwards slowly, and I felt a sudden panic. What if he didn't come? What if he'd got it, but changed his mind? What would I do? Surely he wouldn't do that to me, not after all this. I found myself taking an audible gulp of air and pressed my hand to my chest, trying to steady my nerves.
It's the height, isn't it? A kindly woman next to me reached out and touched my arm. 67 floors up is quite a distance.
I tried to smile. Something like that. If you can't leave your work and your house and all the things that make you happy, I will understand. I'll be sad, but I'll get it. You'll always be with me, one way or the other.
I lied. Of course I lied. Oh, Sam, please say yes. Please be waiting when the doors open again.
And then the lift stopped.
Well, that wasn't 67 floors, someone said, and a couple of people laughed awkwardly.
A baby in a pram gazed at me with wide brown eyes. We all stood for a moment, then someone stepped out.
Oh, that wasn't the main elevator, said the woman beside me, pointing. That's the main elevator.
And there it was, at the far end of an endless snaking horseshoe of people. I stared at it in horror. There must have been 100 visitors, 200 even, milling quietly, staring up at the museum exhibits, the laminated histories on the wall. I looked at my watch. It was already 7:01. I texted Sam, watching in horror as the message refused to send. I started to push my way through the crowd, muttering, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," as people tutted loudly and yelled, "Hey, lady, we're all waiting here." Head down, I made my way past the wall boards that told the story of the Rockefeller building, of its Christmas trees, the video exhibit of NBC, bobbing and weaving, muttering my apologies. There are few grumpier people than overheated tourists who have found themselves waiting in an unexpected queue. One grabbed at my sleeve.
"Hey, you! We're all waiting!"
"I'm meeting someone," I said. "I'm so sorry. I'm English. We're normally very good at queuing, but if I'm any later, I'm going to miss him."
"You can wait like the rest of us."
"Let her go, baby," said the woman beside him, and I mouthed my thanks, pushing on through the morass of sunburnt shoulders, of shifting bodies and querulous children, and I Heart NY t-shirts, the lift doors coming slowly closer. But less than 20 feet away, the queue came to a solid stop. I hopped, trying to see over the top of people's heads, and came face to face with a fake iron girder. It rested against a huge black-and-white photographic backdrop of the New York skyline. Visitors were seating themselves in groups on the structure, mimicking the iconic photograph of workmen eating their lunch during the tower's construction, while a young woman behind a camera yelled at them,
"Put your hands in the air! That's it! Now, thumbs up for New York! That's it! Now, pretend to push each other off! Now, kiss! Okay, pictures will be available when you leave. Next!"
Time after time, she repeated her four phrases as we shifted gradually closer. The only way to get past would mean ruining someone's possibly once-in-a-lifetime 30 rock novelty photograph. It was 7:04. I made to push through to see if I could edge behind her, but found myself blocked by a group of teenagers with rucksacks. Someone shoved my back and we were moving.
"On the girder, please, ma'am."
The way through was blocked by an immovable wall of people. The photographer beckoned. I was going to do whatever would make this move fastest. Obediently, I hoisted myself up onto the girder, muttering under my breath, "Come on, come on, I need to move.
Put your hands in the air. That's it. Now thumbs up for New York."
I put my hands in the air, forced my thumbs up.
"Now pretend to push each other off. That's it. Now kiss."
A teenage boy with glasses turned to me, surprised and then delighted. I shook my head.
"Not this one, bud. Sorry."
I leapt off the girder, pushed past him and ran to the final queue, waiting in front of the lift. It was 7:09. It was at this point that I wanted to cry. I stood squashed in the hot, grumbling queue, shifting from foot to foot and watching as the other lift disgorged people, cursing myself for not doing my research. This was the problem with grand gestures, I realized. They tended to backfire in spectacular fashion. The guards observed my agitation with the indifference of service workers who have seen every kind of human behaviour. And then, finally, at 7:12, the elevator door opened, and a guard herded people towards it, counting our heads. When he got to me, he pulled the rope across.
"Next elevator."
"Oh, come on!"
It's the rules, lady. Please, I have to meet someone. I'm so, so late. Just let me squeeze in, please. I'm begging you.
Can't. Strict on numbers.
But as I let out a small moan of anguish, a woman a few yards away beckoned to me. Here, she said, stepping out of the lift. Take my place. I'll get the next one. Seriously? Gotta love a romantic meeting. Oh, thank you. Thank you, I said as I slid past. I didn't like to tell her the chance of it being romantic, or even a meeting, was growing slimmer by the second. I wedged myself into the lift, conscious of the curious glances of the other passengers, and clenched my fists as the lift started to move. This time, the lift flew upwards at warp speed, causing children to giggle and point as the glass ceiling betrayed how fast we were going. Lights flashed overhead, my stomach turned somersaults. An elderly woman beside me in a floral hat nudged me.
"Want a breath mint?" she said, and winked. "For when you finally see him?"
I took one and smiled nervously.
"I want to know how this goes," she said, and tucked the packet back into her bag. "You come find me."
And then, as my ears popped, the lift began to slow, and we were stopping. Once upon a time, there was a small-town girl who lived in a small world. She was perfectly happy, or at least she told herself she was. Like many girls, she loved to try different looks, to be someone she wasn't. But, like too many girls, life had chipped away at her, until instead of finding what truly suited her, she camouflaged herself, hid the bits that made her different. For a while, she let the world bruise her, until she decided it was safer not to be herself at all. There are so many versions of ourselves we can choose to be. Once, my life was destined to be measured out in the most ordinary of steps. I learnt differently from a man who refused to accept the version of himself he'd been left with, and an old lady who saw, conversely, that she could transform herself right up to a point when many people would have said there was nothing left to be done. I had a choice. I was Louisa Clark from New York, or Louisa Clark from Stortford, or there might be a whole other Louisa I hadn't yet met. The key was making sure that anyone you allowed to walk beside you didn't get to decide which you were, and pin you down like a butterfly in a case. The key was to know that you could always somehow find a way to reinvent yourself again. I would survive if he wasn't there, I reassured myself. After all, I had survived worse. It would just be another reinvention. I told myself this several times as I waited for the lift doors to open. It was 7:17. I walked swiftly to the glass doors, telling myself that surely if he'd come this far he would wait 20 minutes. Then I ran across the deck, spinning and weaving my way through the sightseers, the chatting tourists and selfie-takers, to see if he was there. I ran back through the glass door and across the vast internal lobby until I came to a second deck. He must be on this side. I moved swiftly, in and out, turning to peer into the faces of strangers, eyes trained for one man, slightly taller than everyone around him, his hair dark, his shoulders square. I crisscrossed the tile floor, the evening sun beating down on my head, sweat starting to bloom across my back, as I looked and looked and observed with a sick feeling that he wasn't there.
"Did you find him?" said the elderly woman, grabbing my arm.
I shook my head.
"Go upstairs, honey."
She pointed towards the side of the building.
"Upstairs? There's an upstairs!"
I ran, trying not to look down until I came to a small escalator. This led to yet another observation deck, this one even more packed with visitors. I felt despairing, had a sudden vision of him moving downstairs on the opposite side, even as we spoke, and I would have no way of knowing. "Sam!" I yelled, my heart thumping. "Sam!" A few people glanced at me, but most continued looking outwards, taking selfies or posing against the glass screen. I stood in the middle of the deck and shouted, my voice hoarse, "Sam!" I jabbed at my phone again, trying to send the message again and again.
"Yeah, cell phone coverage is patchy up here."
"You lost someone?" said a uniformed guard, appearing beside me.
"You lost a kid?"
"No, a man. I was meant to meet him here. I didn't know there were two levels. Or so many decks. Oh, God, oh, God, I don't think he's on either of them."
I'll radio over to my colleague, see if he can give him a shout.
He lifted his walkie-talkie to his ear.
But you do know there's actually 3 levels, lady.
He pointed upwards. At this point, I let out a muffled sob. It was 23 minutes past 7. I would never find him. He would have left by now. If he was ever even here in the first place.
Try up there.
The guard took my elbow and pointed to the next set of steps and turned away to speak into his radio.
That's it, right? I said. No more decks.
He grinned.
No more decks.
There are 67 steps between the doors to the second deck of 30 Rockefeller Center and the final, uppermost viewing deck. More if you are wearing vintage satin dancing heels in fuchsia pink, with the elastic straps cut off that really weren't made for running in, especially in a heat wave. I walked slowly this time. I mounted the narrow flight of steps, and halfway up, when I felt something in me might actually burst with anxiety, I turned and looked behind me at the view. Across Manhattan, the sun glowed orange, the endless sea of glittering skyscrapers reflecting back a peach light, the center of the world going about its business. 1 million lives below me, 1 million heartbreaks, big and small, tales of joy and loss and survival, 1 million little victories every day. There is a great consolation in simply doing something you love. In those last few steps, I considered all the ways in which my life was still going to be wonderful. I steadied my breath and thought of my new agency, my friends, my unexpected little dog with his wonky, joyful face. I thought of how in less than 12 months I had survived homelessness and joblessness in one of the toughest cities on earth. I thought of the William Traynor Memorial Library. And when I turned and looked up again, there he was, leaning on the ledge and looking out across the city, his back to me, hair ruffling slightly in the breeze. I stood for a moment as the last of the tourists pushed past me, and I took in his broad shoulders, the way his head tipped forward, the soft dark hair at his collar, and something altered in me, a recalibrating of something deep within, so that I was calm, just at the sight of him. I stood and I stared, and a great sigh escaped me. And perhaps conscious of my gaze, at that moment he turned slowly and straightened, and the smile that spread slowly across his face matched my own. "Hello, Louisa Clark," he said. This audiobook was produced and published by Penguin Books Limited. Recording copyright 2018.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.